Chapter 18. Superunification. A rough sea stretched out over Sado, the Milky Way. Matsuo Basho, 1644 to 1694, poem. Perhaps they had chosen Hokkaido because of its maverick reputation. The climate required construction techniques that were highly unconventional by Japanese standards. And this island was also the home of the Ainu, those hairy aboriginal people still despised by many Japanese. Winters were as severe as the ones in Minnesota or Wyoming. Hokkaido posed certain logistical difficulties, but it was out of the way in case of a catastrophe, being physically separated from the other Japanese islands. It was by no means isolated, however, now that the 51-kilometer-long tunnel connecting it with Honshu had been completed. It was the longest submarine tunnel in the world. Hokkaido had seemed safe enough for the testing of individual machine components, but concern had been expressed about actually assembling the machine in Hokkaido. This was, as the mountains that surrounded the facility bore eloquent testimony, a region surging with recent volcanism. One mountain was growing at a rate of a meter a day. Even the Soviets, Sakhalin Island was only 43 kilometers away across the Soya or La Perouse Strait, had voiced some misgivings on this score, but in for a kopeck, in for a ruble. For all they knew, even a machine built on the far side of the moon could blow up the earth when activated. The decision to build the machine was the key in assessing dangers. Where the thing was built was an entirely secondary consideration. By early July, the machine was once again taking shape. In America, it was still embroiled in political and sectarian controversy, and there were apparently serious technical problems with the Soviet machine. But here, in a facility much more modest than that in Wyoming, the dowels had been mounted and the dodecahedron completed, although no public announcement had been made. The ancient Pythagoreans who first discovered the dodecahedron had declared its very existence a secret, and the penalties for disclosure were severe. So perhaps it was only fitting that this house-sized dodecahedron, halfway around the world and 2,600 years later, was known only to a few. The Japanese project director had decreed a few days' rest for everyone. The nearest city of any size was Obihiro, a pretty place at the confluence of the Ubetsu and Tokachi rivers. Some went to ski on strips of unmelted snow on Mount Asai, others to dam thermal streams with a makeshift rock wall, warming themselves with the decay of radioactive elements cooked in some supernova explosion billions of years before. A few of the project personnel went to the Bamba races, in which massive draft horses pulled heavy ballasted sledges over parallel strips of farmland. But for a serious celebration, the five flew by helicopter to Sapporo, the largest city on Hokkaido, situated less than 200 kilometers away. Propitiously enough, they arrived in time for the Tanabata festival. The security risk was considered small because it was the machine itself, much more than these five people, that was essential for the success of the project. They had undergone no special training beyond thorough study of the machine, the message, and the miniaturized instruments that they would take with them. In a rational world, they would be easy to replace, Elliot thought, although the political impediments in selecting five humans acceptable to all members of the World Machine Consortium had been considerable. She and Vege had unfinished business, they said, which could not be completed except over Saki. So she, Devi Sukhavati, and Aboneva Eda found themselves guided by their Japanese hosts along one of the side streets of the Odori Promenade, past elaborate displays of paper streamers and lanterns, pictures of leaves, turtles, and ogres, and appealing cartoon representations of a young man and woman in medieval costume. Between two buildings was stretched a large piece of sailcloth on which had been painted a peacock rampant. She glanced at Eda in his flowing embroidered linen robe and high stiff cap, and at Sukhavati in yet another stunning silk sari and delighted in the company. The Japanese machine had so far passed all the prescribed tests, and a crew had been agreed upon that was not merely representative, if imperfectly, of the population of the planet, but which included genuine individuals, not stamped out by the official cookie cutters of five nations. Every one of them was, in some sense, a rebel. Edda, for instance, here he was, the great physicist, the discoverer of what was called superunification, one elegant theory which included, as special cases, physics that run the gamut from gravitations to quarks. It was an achievement comparable to Isaac Newton's or Albert Einstein's, and Edda was being compared to both. He had been born a Muslim in Nigeria, not unusual in itself, but he was an adherent of an unorthodox Islamic faction called the Ahmadiyya, which encompassed the Sufis. The Sufis, he explained, after the evening with Abbot Utsumi, were to Islam what Zen was to Buddhism. Ahmadiyya proclaimed a jihad of the pen, not the sword. Despite his quiet, indeed humble demeanour, Edda was a fierce opponent of the more conventional Muslim concept of jihad, holy war, and argued instead for the most vigorous free exchange of ideas. In this he was an embarrassment for much of conservative Islam, and opposition to his participation in the machine crew had been made by some Islamic nations, nor were they alone. A black Nobel laureate, said occasionally to be the smartest person on earth, proved too much for some who had masked their racism as a concession to the new social amenities. When Edda visited Tyrone Free in prison 4 years earlier, there was a marked upsurge in pride among black Americans, and a new role model for the young. Edda brought out the worst in the racists, and the best in everyone else. "The time necessary to do physics is a luxury," he told Ellie. "There are many people who could do the same if they had the same opportunity, but if you must search the streets for food, you will not have enough time for physics. It is my obligation to improve conditions for young scientists in my country." As he had slowly become a national hero in Nigeria, he spoke out increasingly about corruption, about an unfair sense of entitlement, about the importance of honesty in science and everywhere else, about how great a nation Nigeria could be. It had as many people as the United States in the 1920s, he said. It was rich in resources, and its many cultures were a strength. If Nigeria could overcome its problems, he argued, it would be a beacon for the rest of the world. Seeking quiet and isolation in all other things, on these issues he spoke out. Many Nigerian men and women, Muslims, Christians, and animists, the young but not only the young, took his vision seriously. Of Edda's many remarkable traits, perhaps the most striking was his modesty. He rarely offered opinions. His answers to the most direct questions were laconic. Only in his writings or in spoken language, after you knew him well, did you glimpse his depth. Amidst all the speculation about the message and the machine and what would happen after its activation, Edda had volunteered only one comment. "In Mozambique," the story goes, "monkeys do not talk, because they know if they utter even a single word, some man will come and put them to work." With such a voluble crew, it was strange to have someone as taciturn as Edda. Like many others, Ellie paid especial attention to even his most casual utterances. He would describe as foolish errors his earlier, only partly successful version of superunification. The man was in his 30s, and Ellie and Devi had privately agreed, devastatingly attractive. He was also, she knew, happily married to one wife. She and their children were in Lagos at the moment. A stand of bamboo cuttings that had been planted for such occasions was adorned, festooned, indeed weighed down, with thousands of strips of coloured paper. Young men and women especially could be seen augmenting the strange foliage. The Tanabata festival is unique in Japan for its celebration of love. Representations of the central story were displayed on multi-panel signs, and in a performance on a makeshift outdoor stage, two stars were in love but separated by the Milky Way. Only once a year, on the seventh day of the seventh month of the lunar calendar, could the lovers contrive to meet, provided it did not rain. Ellie looked up at the crystalline blue of this alpine sky and wished the lovers well. The young man star, the legend went, was a Japanese sort of cowboy and was represented by the A7 dwarf star, Altair. The young woman was a weaver and represented by Vega. It seemed odd to Ellie that Vega should be central to a Japanese festival a few months before machine activation. But if you survey enough cultures, you will probably find interesting legends about every bright star in the sky. The legend was of Chinese origin and had been alluded to by Xi when she heard him years ago at the first meeting of the World Message Consortium in Paris. In most of the big cities, the Tanabata festival was dying. Arranged marriages had ceased to be the norm, and the anguish of the separated lovers no longer struck so responsive a chord as it once had. But in a few places, Sapporo, Sendai, and a few others, the festival grew more popular each year. In Sapporo, it had a special poignancy because of the still widespread outrage at Japanese Ainu marriages. There was an entire cottage industry of detectives on the island who would, for a fee, investigate the relatives and antecedents of possible spouses for your children. Ainu ancestry was still held to be a ground for summary rejection. Devi, remembering her young husband of many years before, was especially scathing. Ada doubtless had heard a story or two along the same line, but he was silent. The Tanabata Festival in the Honshu city of Sendai was now a staple on Japanese television for people who now could rarely see the real Altair or Vega. She wondered if the Vegans would continue broadcasting the same message to the Earth forever. Partly because the machine was being completed in Japan, it received considerable attention in the television commentary accompanying this year's Tanabata Festival. But the Five, as they were now sometimes called, had not been required to appear on Japanese television, and their presence here in Sapporo for the festival was not generally known. Nevertheless, Ada, Sukhavati, and Shi were readily recognized, and they made their way back to the Obori promenade to the accompaniment of polite, scattered applause by passers-by. Many also bowed. A loudspeaker outside a music shop blared a rock and roll piece that Ellie recognized. It was "I Wanna Ricochet Off You" by the black music group White Noise. In the afternoon sun was a roomy-eyed elderly dog, which, as she approached, wagged its tail feebly. Japanese commentators talked of Machindo, the way of the machine, the increasingly common perspective of the Earth as a planet, and of all humans sharing an equal stake in its future. Something like it had been proclaimed in some, but by no means all, religions. Practitioners of those religions, understandably, resented the insight being attributed to an alien machine. If the acceptance of a new insight on our place in the universe represents a religious conversion, she mused, then a theological revolution was sweeping the earth. Even the American and European Kiliasts had been influenced by Machindo. But if the machine didn't work, and the message went away, how long, she wondered, would the insight last? Even if we had made some mistake in interpretation or construction, she thought, even if we never understood anything more about the Vegans, the message demonstrated beyond a shadow of a doubt that there were other beings in the universe, and that they were more advanced than we. That should help keep the planet unified for a while, she thought. She asked Ada if he had ever had a transforming religious experience. Yes, he said. When? Sometimes you had to encourage him to talk. When I first picked up Euclid, and also when I first understood Newtonian gravitation, and Maxwell's equations, and general relativity. And during my work on superunification, I have been fortunate enough to have had many religious experiences. No, she returned, you know what I mean. Apart from science, never, he replied instantly. Never apart from science. He told her a little of the religion that he had been born into. He did not consider himself bound by all its tenets, he said, but he was comfortable with it. He thought it could do much good. It was a comparatively new sect, contemporaneous with Christian Science or the Jehovah Witnesses, founded by Mirza Ghulam Ahmad in the Punjab. Davy apparently knew something about the Ahmadiyya as a proselytizing sect. It had been especially successful in West Africa. The origins of the religion were wrapped in eschatology. Ahmad had claimed to be the Mahdi, the figure that Muslims expect to appear at the end of the world. He also claimed to be Christ come again, an incarnation of Krishna and a Burus, or reappearance of Muhammad. Christian Kellyism had now infected the Ahmadiyya, and his reappearance was imminent, according to some of the faithful. The year 2008, the centenary of Ahmad's death, was now a favoured date for his final return as Mahdi. The global messianic fervour, while sputtering, seemed on average to be swelling still further, and Ellie confessed concern about the irrational predilections of the human species. "At a festival of love," said Devi, "you should not be such a pessimist." In Sapporo there had been an abundant snowfall, and the local custom of making snow and ice sculptures of animals and mythological figures was updated. An immense dodecahedron had been meticulously carved and was shown regularly as a kind of icon on the evening news. After unseasonably warm days, the ice sculptors could be seen packing, chipping and grinding, repairing the damage. That the activation of the machine might, one way or another, trigger a global apocalypse was a fear now often being voiced. The machine project responded with confident guarantees to the public, quiet assurances to the governments, and decrees to keep the activation time secret. Some scientists proposed activation on November the 17th, an evening on which was predicted the most spectacular meteor shower of the century. It was an agreeable symbolism, they said. But Valerian argued that if the machine was to leave the Earth at that moment, having to fly through a cloud of cometary debris would provide an additional and unnecessary hazard. So, activation was postponed for a few weeks until the end of the last month of 1900 and anything. While this date was not literally the turn of the millennium, but a year before, celebrations on a lavish scale were planned by those who couldn't be bothered to understand the calendrical conventions or who wished to celebrate the coming of the third millennium in two consecutive Decembers. Although the extraterrestrials could not have known how much each crew member weighed, they specified in painstaking detail the mass of each machine component and the total permissible mass. Very little was left over for equipment of terrestrial design. This fact had some years before been used as an argument for an all-woman crew, so that the equipment allowance could be increased, but the suggestion had been rejected as frivolous. There was no room for spacesuits. They would have to hope the Vegans would remember that humans had a propensity for breathing oxygen. With virtually no equipment of their own, with their cultural differences and their unknown destination, it was clear that the mission might entail great risk. The world press discussed it often. The five themselves, never. A variety of miniature cameras, spectrometers, superconducting supercomputers, and microfilm libraries were being urged on the crew. It made sense and it didn't make sense. There were no sleeping or cooking or toilet facilities on board the machine. They were taking only a minimum of provisions, some of them stuffed in the pockets of their coveralls. Devi was to carry a rudimentary medical kit. As far as she was concerned, Ellie thought she was barely planning to bring a toothbrush and a change of underwear. Even if they can get me to Vega in a chair, she thought, well, they'd probably be able to provide the amenities as well. If she needed a camera, she told project officials, she'd just ask the Vegans for one. There was a body of opinion, apparently serious, that the five should go naked. Since clothing had not been specified, it should not be included, because it might somehow disturb the functioning of the machine. Ellie and Devi, among others, were amused and noted that there was no prescription against wearing clothing. a popular human custom evident in the Olympic broadcasts. The Vegans knew we wore clothes, she and Vega protested. The only restrictions were on total mass. Should we also extract dental work, they asked, and leave eyeglasses behind? Their view carried the day, in part because of the reluctance of many nations to be associated with the project culminating so indecorously. But the debate generated a little raw humour among the press, the technicians, and the five. For that matter, Lunacharsky said, it doesn't actually specify that human beings are the goal. Maybe they would send five chimpanzees. They would find those equally acceptable. Even a single two-dimensional photograph of an alien machine could be invaluable, she was told. And imagine a picture of the aliens themselves. Or would she please reconsider and bring a camera? Dehir, who was now in Hokkaido with a large American delegation, told her to be serious. The stakes were too high, he said, but she cut him short with a look so withering that he could not complete the sentence. In her mind, she knew what he was going to say. For childish behavior. Amazingly, Dehir was acting as if he had been the injured party in their relationship. She described it all to Devi, who was not fully sympathetic. Dehir, she said, was very sweet. Eventually, Ellie agreed to take an ultra-miniaturized video camera. In the manifest that the project required under personal effects, she listed frond, palm, 0.811 kilograms. Dehir was sent to reason with her. You know there's a splendid infrared imaging system you can carry along for 2/3 of a kilogram. Why would you want to take the branch of a tree? A frond, she corrected. It's a palm frond. I know you grew up in New York, but you must know what a palm tree is. It's all in Ivanhoe. Didn't you read it in high school? At the time of the Crusades, pilgrims who made the long journey to the Holy Land took back a palm frond to show they'd really been there. It's to keep my spirits up. I don't care how advanced they are. The earth is my holy land. I'll bring a frond to them to show them where I come from. Dehir only shook his head. But when she described her reasons to Vega, he said, Now this I understand very well. Ellie remembered Vega's concerns and the story he had told her in Paris about the droshky sent to the impoverished village. But this was not her worry at all. The palm frond served another purpose, she realized. She needed something to remind her of Earth. She was afraid she might be tempted not to come back. The day before the machine was to be activated, she received a small package that had been delivered by hand to her apartment on the site in Wyoming and transshipped by courier. There was no return address, and inside no note, no signature. The package held a gold medallion on a chain. Conceivably, it could be used as a pendulum. An inscription had been engraved on both sides, small but readable. One side, she read, Hera, superb queen, with the golden robes, commanded Argus, whose glances bristle out through the world. On the obverse, she read, This is the response of the defenders of Sparta to the commander of the Roman army. If you are a god, you will not hurt those who have never injured you. If you are a man, advance, and you will find men equal to yourself and women. She knew who'd sent it. Next day, activation day, they took an opinion poll of the senior staff on what would happen. Most thought nothing would happen, that the machine would not work. A smaller number believed that the five would somehow find themselves very quickly in the Vega system, relativity to the contrary notwithstanding. Others suggested variously that the machine was a vehicle for exploring the solar system, the most expensive practical joke in history, a classroom, a time machine, or a galactic telephone booth. One scientist wrote, Five very ugly replacements with green scales and sharp teeth will slowly materialize in the chairs. This was the closest to the Trojan horse scenario in any of the responses. Another, but only one, read Doomsday Machine. There was a ceremony of sorts. Speeches were made. Food and drink were served. People hugged one another. Some cried quietly. Only a few were openly sceptical. You could sense that if anything at all happened on activation, the response would be thunderous. There was an intimation of joy in many faces. Ellie managed to call the nursing home and wish her mother goodbye. She spoke the words into the mouthpiece on Hokkaido, and in Wisconsin the identical sound was generated, but there was no response. Her mother was recovering some motor functions on her stricken side, the nurse told her. Soon she might be able to speak a few words. By the time the call had been completed, Ellie was feeling almost light-hearted. The Japanese technicians were wearing hachimaki, cloth bands around their heads, that were traditionally donned in preparation for mental, physical, or spiritual effort, especially combat. Printed on the headband was a conventional projection of the map of the earth. No single nation held a dominant position. There had not been very much in the way of national briefings. As far as she could tell, no one had been urged to rally round the flag. National leaders sent short statements on videotape. The president's was especially fine, Ellie thought. This is not a briefing and not a farewell. It's just a so long. Each of you makes this journey on behalf of a billion souls. You represent all the peoples of the planet Earth. If you are to be transported to somewhere else, then see for all of us, not just the science, but everything you can learn. You represent the entire human species, past, present, and future. Whatever happens, your place in history is secure. You are heroes of our planet. Speak for all of us. Be wise. And come back. A few hours later, for the first time, they entered the machine, one by one, through a small airlock. Recessed interior lights, very low-key, came on. Even after the machine had been completed and had passed every prescribed test, they were afraid to have the five take their places prematurely. Some project personnel worried that merely sitting down might induce the machine to operate, even if the Benzels were stationary. But here they were, and nothing extraordinary was happening so far. This was the first moment she was able to lean back, a little gingerly, to be sure, into the moulded and cushioned plastic. She had wanted chintz. Chintz slipcovers would have been perfect for these chairs, but even this, she discovered, was a matter of national pride. The plastic seemed more modern, more scientific, more serious. Knowing of Vega's careless smoking habits, they had decreed that no cigarettes could be carried on board the machine. Lunacharsky had uttered fluent maledictions in 10 languages. Now he entered, after the others, having finished his last lucky strike. He wheezed just a little as he sat down beside her. There were no seat belts in the design extracted from the message, so there were none in the machine. Some project personnel had argued, nevertheless, that it was foolhardy to omit them. The machine goes somewhere, she thought. It was a means of conveyance, an aperture to elsewhere, or elsewhen. It was a freight train, barreling and wailing into the night. If you'd climbed aboard it, it could carry you out to the stifling provincial towns of your childhood, to the great crystal cities. It was discovery and escape, and an end to loneliness. Every logistical delay in manufacture and every dispute over the proper interpretation of some sub-codicil of the instructions had plunged her into despair. It was not glory she was seeking, not mainly, not much, but instead a kind of liberation. She was a wonder junkie. In her mind, she was a hill tribesman, standing slack-jawed before the real Ishtar Gate of ancient Babylon, Dorothy catching her first glimpse of the vaulted spires of the Emerald City of Oz. A small boy from darkest Brooklyn, plunked down in the corridor of nations of the 1939 World's Fair, the Trilon and Perisphere beckoning in the distance. She was Pocahontas, sailing up the Thames estuary with London spread out before her from horizon to horizon. Her heart sang in anticipation. She would discover, she was sure, what else is possible. What could be accomplished by other beings, great beings, beings who had, it seemed likely, been voyaging between the stars when the ancestors of humans were still brachiating from branch to branch in the dappled sunlight of the forest canopy. Drumlin, like many others that she had known over the years, had called her an incurable romantic, and she found herself wondering again why so many people thought this some embarrassing disability. Her romanticism had been a driving force in her life and a fount of delights. Advocate and practitioner of romance, she was off to see the wizard. A status report came through by radio. There were no apparent malfunctions, so far as could be detected, with the battery of instrumentation that had been set up exterior to the machine. Their main wait was for the evacuation of the space between and around the Benzels. A system of extraordinary efficiency was pumping out the air to attain the highest vacuum ever reached on Earth. She double-checked the stowage of her video micro-camera system and gave the palm frond a pat. Powerful lights on the exterior of the dodecahedron had turned on. Two of the spherical shells had now spun up to what the message had defined as critical speed. It was already a blur to those watching outside. The third Benzel would be there in a minute. A strong electrical charge was building up. When all three spherical shells, with their mutually perpendicular axes, were up to speed, the machine would be activated. Or so the message had said. She's face showed fierce determination, she thought. Lunacharsky's, a deliberate calm. Sukhavati's eyes were open, wide. Edda revealed only an attitude of quiet attentiveness. Devi caught her glance and smiled. She wished she had had a child. It was her last thought before the walls flickered and became transparent, and, it seemed, the earth opened up and swallowed her.